Moving on, we'll go to, oh yes, I forgot to mention that like yesterday, I want to ask you to please hold your questions until the end. We will have a longer question period at the end where we can address all these, all questions that you may have.
Nous allons maintenant passer à des présentations qui touchent la question des changements climatiques plus directement. Je vais commencer avec une autre question pour les télévoteurs. Ça, c'est une question où il y a une bonne réponse. Alors, on va essayer de trouver laquelle c'est. La question, c'est de savoir quel pourcentage des besoins énergétiques du Québec est comblé par les hydrocarbures. Ça comprend le gaz naturel. C'est une bonne question. Ça comprend le pétrole, ça comprend le gaz naturel, ça comprend tous les genres d'hydrocarbures qu'on peut utiliser pour satisfaire nos besoins énergétiques. Si vous étiez là hier, il y avait une question qui peut peut-être vous donner une petite idée de c'est quoi la réponse. Si vous étiez pas là, c'est pas grave. Vous pouvez parler avec votre voisin. Peut-être que votre voisin était là et peut vous aider à trouver la bonne réponse. Alors, ça varie entre 25 % et 65 % Je vais ouvrir la votation et comme je dis, vous êtes à l'aise de parler avec votre voisin pour essayer de décider laquelle de ces réponses-là est la bonne. Il manque encore des votes. On entend différentes opinions. Est-ce qu'il y a d'autres votes? Tout le monde a fait son choix? Ça va? Alors, on va arrêter. Voici les réponses, donc 48 % à 55 % et c'est effectivement la bonne réponse. Pour vous donner un petit peu plus de détails, de ce 55 %, 40 % c'est du pétrole, 14 % du gaz naturel, 1 % toutes les autres. Okay. Alors en fait, c'est 55 % des hydrocarbures, 40 % des besoins énergétiques satisfaits par du pétrole. Alors, cette question-là de l'importance du pétrole, du rôle que ça joue, ça nous touche directement quand on parle de la problématique des changements climatiques et de la réduction des gaz à effet de serre. Alors, je vais vous poser une prochaine question qui est la suivante. Alors, vis-à-vis du phénomène du réchauffement climatique, avant qu'on en parle ici ce soir, plus en détail, laquelle des affirmations suivantes correspond le mieux à votre opinion? Alors, A, le réchauffement climatique n'est pas prouvé scientifiquement. B, le réchauffement climatique est scientifiquement prouvé, mais rien ne prouve que ce sont les activités humaines qui sont en cause. C, le réchauffement climatique est une réalité et il n'y a aucun doute, il y a un mot très important qui manque, il n'y a aucun doute qu'il est causé par les activités humaines. Et D, sans opinion, je ne sais pas, je manque d'informations pour vraiment prendre une décision. Alors, on va ouvrir le vote dans un instant. Voilà. Allez-y. Ici, la bonne réponse est celle que vous croyez. Ça va? Nous avons tous fait notre choix. Alors, voilà les résultats. 87 % c'est une réalité. Il n'y a aucun doute qu'il a été causé par les activités humaines. 12 % on n'est pas sûr que c'est les activités humaines qui en sont la cause, mais on croit que le réchauffement climatique est scientifiquement prouvé. 2 % de sceptiques. Alors, c'est peut-être une représentation qui n'est pas trop loin d'une représentation de la population en général, mais on va le savoir à un moment donné. On fait que les 2% se lèvent. J'y ai songé, Christophe, mais je me suis dit, je le dirai pas. Je le dirai pas cette fois-ci. Mais c'est une question qu'en fait,
qu'on va, on a un projet, l'Institut Trottier, un projet conjoint avec le Cyrano, où on va faire un sondage au niveau des perceptions des Québécois. On va avoir une meilleure idée aussi au niveau de ces thématiques-là dans quelques semaines. Alors, parlons un peu du réchauffement climatique. And we move on to our next speaker to address the forecasting paradox related to the issue. And again, I invite Subhasis Ghoshal to come and introduce our next speaker.
So now I have the pleasure of introducing Dr. Richard O'Neill. Dr. O'Neill is the Chief Economic Advisor at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission in the U.S. Previously, he was the Director of the Office of Economic Policy and Office of Pipeline and Producer Regulation. From 1978 to 1986, he also directed the Oil and Gas Analysis and Forecasting at the Energy Information Administration. Prior to that, he was a faculty member at Louisiana State University and at University of Maryland. Dr. O'Neill's work focuses on open access, restructuring, competition, performance-based regulation, market power mitigation, and market design. So with that, I welcome you to the floor.
The clicker. I will apologize in advance. I'm getting over a cold that I caught in Whistler a couple weeks ago, so I'm blaming it on the Canadians. So, I've been in the energy business in one way or another for 40 years. I've been a modeler. I've been a forecaster. I've been a consumer of forecasts and studies. And I'd like to sort of give you some of my observations over that period of time. We can start off with nuclear. Most of you probably are familiar with the expression that a chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission in the U.S. said. He said essentially that our children will experience power too cheap to meter. It turned out that too cheap actually was too expensive. And the reason why is that since the 60s, every estimate of nuclear power has come in at least twice as high and almost four times as high. And that we had a hiatus in building nuclear plants in the U.S., but we got going again in the 2010s, and we're experiencing the same problem. Now, we had a big energy policy debate in the 70s in the States, and it ended up in a huge legislative package in 1978. The theory behind the package was we were running out of oil and natural gas. We decided that we would outlaw the use of natural gas in electric generation because we needed to save the gas for residential consumers and in certain industrial production. We encouraged very strongly the use of coal in electric generation. The Natural Gas Policy Act was designed essentially to put us on a glide path for running out of natural gas. And the Natural Gas Act of 1938 was at the time a cradle to grave, that is to say, burner tip to consumption, set of regulations which were essentially our good old friendly cost-based rate of return regulation. If you wanted to build a pipeline, you needed to come in to the commission with 20 years worth of reserves, gas reserves, contracted in advance. This was an interesting proposition because, in some sense, this requirement contributed to the theory of running out that panicked in the 70s, because people to come in and build a pipeline would overestimate their reserves or overstate their reserves. And then once the production came online, they were forced, because they were publicly traded companies, to reevaluate their reserves based on their production history, and they had to write down a huge amount of reserves in the 70s, and people interpreted that as running out when it was just really a paper transaction. And we passed the Public Utilities Regulatory Policy Act, which, and we, if you were here last night, we had a discussion on feed-in tariffs. My claim is this is the original feed-in tariff. It required wind, solar, and cogen facilities to be purchased by the local utility at avoided costs. And avoided cost in the legislation has a very good economic interpretation, but what happened was is when this was implemented at the state level, avoided cost became a feed-in tariff in some states and a disaster in others. California put tariffs in that were, I believe, 10 cents a kilowatt hour, which was way above market, so they got a lot of wind, and so did New York and Maine. And Louisiana and Texas got a lot of cogen because they had a lot of industry in Texas, and the cogen was a good option. So we started the feed-in tariff issue, but it took little notice. Now, how did the 70s create all this panic? Well, we peaked in the U.S. Our oil production peaked in 1973. And then started the fall, had a brief rise again, and then started the fall again. And so a lot of people bought into this theory of peak oil. And if you were into this at the time, it was championed by a guy named M. King Hubbard, who fit this curve, obviously not the far end of it, and saw that we were going to just simply run out. And everybody believed religiously that this curve that he had fitted to the data was the reality, was the science of oil production. And then all of a sudden, oil gets a second act. And nobody, virtually nobody, expected it. And the second act was essentially a technology act. The technology of oil and gas production has improved continuously over the 40 years that I've been in this business, and almost none of it was anticipated. And I guess that's the sort of the basis of innovation. You don't really anticipate it, and it comes all of a sudden. Recently, the crude prices have dropped significantly. Saudi Arabia has publicly claimed that it's not their fault. Everybody is sort of blames it on the Saudis. If you look at who the winners and losers are, you can see that the losers are, in at least three cases, the archenemies of Saudi Arabia. And the winners are you know, who you would expect, the people who are consuming oil. And the United States is sort of neutral because we both produce a lot of oil, but I think people estimate that the net benefit is positive because we also consume a lot of oil. Now, natural gas essentially followed the same pattern. It peaked in 1973. And I'm not going to show you the full data series. We're going to stop at 1980 because here I was in charge of oil and gas forecasting at the U.S. Energy Agency, at EIA. And I had to make a forecast for 5, 10, and 15 years out in 1980. And this is the graph, historical graph of prices. And so what's a person to do, but project that they will continue to go up. And so here are the results for forecasting, and I won't go through all of them because there's a lot of data. But look at the forecast in the left-hand side. They're the forecast for natural gas prices in 1995, or for 1995 in 1980. The top line is EIA's forecast, which I was primarily responsible for. The DOE, which had its own separate organization because it didn't like the way we forecast, forecasted $8. DRI, which was a commercial forecasting entity, had 15. The actual price in 1995 dollars was $1.59. So the average forecast was off by a factor of 6. My only consolation was I was the best of the group. And the same pattern holds for 10 years out and 5 years out, except it's not quite as bad. You get a little bit better when you don't have to go out 15 years. Here is the history. What we see is 1995 was the lowest point for natural gas prices in the last, I don't know how many, 30 years. And the prices have virtually no pattern that you can detect statistically. And natural gas got a second act. And it's a second act, essentially towards the end, was what we call shale gas, horizontal drilling, and fracking. And the interesting thing is that horizontal drilling was not new. Fracking was not new. But the combination of the two and some, again, increases in technology allows you to go after the shale gas, which when I was at the Department of Energy in oil and gas analysis, if you would have gotten the shale gas revolution completely correct in 1980, we would have found you a job in another organization because you would have been certified as a little bit loony. So now, just around the mid-80s, I started to question my ability to forecast. And luckily, I got a job offer from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which didn't require me to forecast. So I took it. I'll ask this question and answer it at the end of the presentation. I don't think anybody could get it right unless I gave you multiple choice, and then I'm not sure you'd get it right either. Just as an aside, there was a book published a couple of years ago by a person named Nate Silver called The Signal and the Noise. Nate is an interesting guy. He's what I would describe as an all-in Bayesian. He revises his forecast based on whatever information sort of comes his way. He was a former professional gambler, but gave up when he realized that his losing streak at poker was not just a stochastic issue. He sort of lost his edge, I think. But he became very famous for predicting congressional races in the United States, and essentially his predictions in 2008 brought him into the sort of fame and fortune that he now enjoys. He makes an interesting observation, which was nothing but confirming for me, and that is that those with an agenda are the worst forecasters because they're really not telling you what they think is going to happen. They're telling you what they want to happen. And he also believes that forecasters should be required to bet on their own forecast to put a little bit of incentive in the pot, so to speak. And he makes an interesting observation that even the most successful gamblers only win about 55% of the time. Why have we been surprised by oil and gas? They're essentially, well, first of all, when we were forecasting for the government, the rule was you had to start with the U.S. Geological Survey's numbers on what was there to be recovered. And the U.S. Geological Survey was very conservative. It got the number wrong. You can simply prove that you've gotten the number wrong by essentially producing more than the number itself. And that happened several times. And we missed just about every innovation that you could possibly imagine. And then for gas, we have this resource that's sitting around all over the world called hydrates. We don't know how to do this commercially yet, but there's lots of methane. In the United States, natural gas was essentially a bridge fuel until the last year or two, and it has turned into the enemy of climate change. Now, the myopia in electricity or in gas essentially flowed over into electricity over the last several years, where ISO New England didn't, for some reason, anticipate what was going to happen in natural gas. And even though they run very, very sophisticated models on contingencies, one of their contingency had nothing to do with the pipeline, which was congested and couldn't meet the needs. Well, couldn't is probably the wrong thing to say. It always met the needs, but sometimes at very high prices. They've never had to curtail anybody in New England for the purposes of pipeline capacity. And interestingly enough, the generators didn't fully winterize. And this last year, or 2 years ago, this was a big problem. They essentially worried a lot this year. The winter was just about as bad, but we didn't have names for it like polar vortex and things like that. And we got through it fairly well. Now, just to show you how good people are at forecasting, I've listed some of my favorites. In 1894, the Times of London projected that in 50 years, every street in London would be under 9 feet of manure. If you look at the time here, Benz was already already had a commercial vehicle that he was willing to sell you, a very respected newspaper. Samuel Morse was convinced that no one would use the telephone. He may have been right, but his timing may have been wrong, because apparently the millennials, I can't call my kids. I have to text them. They will not, it's like I'm interrupting them if I give them a telephone call. He was right, but his timing was wrong. He shouldn't have sold his stock back at the turn of the last century, but he probably could have gotten away with doing it this one. Lord Kelvin, a skeptic about radio, flying, x-rays. In 29, Irving Fisher said that stocks were in a permanently high plateau. Einstein saying that he didn't think nuclear power would be ever obtainable. If he would have just added inexpensive nuclear power, he probably would have been right. Now, some other ones, 43, Thomas Watson said there was a market for 5 computers, maybe. The head of Digital Equipment Corporation said that there's no reason anyone would want a computer in their home. The founder of FedEx was a student at Yale and turned in the FedEx proposal as a term paper, and his professor said, interesting, well-formed, but you can't get better than a C unless the project is feasible. And in 72, Limits to Growth had us running out of oil several years ago. the climate change issue is a very tough issue because the media can't stop itself from taking singular events and turning them into climate change, which is just wrong. The man on the street has a hard time seeing climate change or feeling climate change. But we know that pricing externalities work. I mean, we had a discussion yesterday about CO2 prices, but it wasn't that the market for these permits doesn't work. It's that you allowed too many to be issued and didn't have the political courage to withdraw them in order to keep the price right. But at the same time, you introduced a subsidy for wind and solar that drove the price down and essentially decarbonized a large part of the market. So it's not hard to understand why the prices are low for carbon in the markets. Now, the most successful pricing of externalities was the CO2 market, which was the first real cap and trade market anywhere. And it worked unbelievably well because the permits were actually in the legislation. Who got the permits was so important, people realized it was so important that they actually put it in the legislation. And the big problem with climate change models is that dynamic, and dynamic models are classically chaotic and have to be choked back for one reason or another. Now, by the way, I'm not predicting this study will appear in 2113. There's a typo. It's an MIT professor named Robert Pindyke, an economist with very little axe to grind in terms of climate policy, wrote a paper on climate policy where he looked at the models that they were using and decided that the models had flaws and created a perception of knowledge and precision that was illusory and misleading. At the end of his paper, he concluded that just as an insurance policy, a $30 per ton tax would be a good idea. I don't know whether he was trying to regain credibility with his fellow faculty members or not. One of the things he pointed out was the discount factor. I think you've heard that in several places over the last 2 days. The problem with economic models is that you can't not have a discount factor, and a very, very high discount factor like 99.99 is usually considered unrealistic. So something around 0.95 is correct, but if it's 0.95, by the time you get it 100 years, it doesn't really matter. All the important things happen in the early years in these models, and people have been trying to counter this economic phenomena and really haven't been very successful. And the other thing is that we are not very good at tech forecasting, and just simply extending trends doesn't do you a whole lot of good, at least when you're looking back. Now, the international problem. I would claim that if you took climate change off of the table and looked at the country's strategic policy, you can probably predict where they're going to be on climate policy. And for example, the Germans and the Japanese pay a very high price for fossil fuels. They have security of supply problems because they import a lot. And consequently, wind and solar solve some of their strategic problems. For India and China, they're probably paying more attention to the fact that they're trying to get their population out of poverty than they are in climate change. Now, the U.S. and Canada have lots of fossil fuels, but at least in the U.S., you can't get climate policy through for very strange, but for political reasons. But there are political coalitions for subsidizing wind and solar. One of the reasons is that wind essentially the wind is in the Midwest, and the Midwest is highly conservative and against climate change, but the politicians in the West have to vote for the subsidy for wind because it goes to their constituents. So, who benefits? Without climate change, I would argue that Western Europe, Japan, and South Korea essentially would pursue the same policy as if no climate change existed. And in some sense, the reluctant people coming to the table don't have the congruence with their strategic policy, and so consequently, they're hedging their bets and making different kinds of arguments. Now, to solve a lot of these problems, we instituted something in the United States we called integrated resource planning. It started out to solve the problems we created in the 80s, or that emerged in the 80s from the 70s, where we essentially had lots of oil-fired generators, and then all of a sudden decided we didn't want any, and we had nuclear cost overruns. And so what happened was is that integrated resource planning was where everybody got together and talked about the problem, something like this. But it was described in the United States as the worst of central planning and due process. And the people in the room weren't going to bear the risk of being wrong. Let me skip over this. Now, just to conclude, forecasting is a profitable business for some. In order to be successful at forecasting, there's some lessons you have to take into account, and that is note when the timing is right. As I said before, if you would have gotten the shale revolution exactly right in 1980, we would have found another job for you. But if you'd have gotten it right in 2010, you'd be championed as a sort of a genius. Be ready to explain why you got your forecast wrong and do it glibly. And be able to defend your assumptions and your model. Sometimes forecasters love to say, well, I was given these assumptions, so that's why the results were wrong. And the other thing in the States is get institutionalized. In our litigated process in the United States, models that are heavily used, whether they're right or wrong, become more valid evidence the more the courts accept the results. And so there's a big problem with old models. They may not be working at all, but they've gone through this process of validating themselves through the legal process, and it's very hard to dislodge them. There's a model, I hope I'm not stepping on anybody's toe, called ProMod that was created in the 60s to do electricity forecasting. It hasn't changed a lot now. There are probably better models out there, but ProMod maintains the position of being used over and over again, which gives it validity in and of itself. All right, would anybody like to, I don't have a clicker here, who's the best econometrician of all time? Schumpeter? He's just a free market type who realized that, unlike Marx, he believed that the people would get reemployed in the new innovative industries rather than become unemployed. But that's a side issue. I'll give you a hint. It has something to do with Galileo. Now, Galileo is very famous for championing the Copernican model of the universe, because before the Copernican model, we had a different model. The sun was set in the background. But so what? Who is the best forecaster? Ptolemy. Now, Ptolemy had a system for predicting where the stars and the planets were going to be, but it was really accurate. But it was based on the wrong model. It wasn't the solar system model. It was a way that this is a very bright guy. With the wrong model, he produced better results than the right model produced for nearly a century in predicting where the planets and the stars were going to be. And it's fascinating to read. He did it all with geometric constructions. So thank you.
Thank you, Dick.